I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.
Hi there, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, for this half-hour journey through culinary history. And today, actually, there are a lot of historical things to mention. Every time I don't know whether it's fall, because it's fall or what, but every time I turn around, there are new announcements of things that places and people who are celebrating anniversaries. The Oyster Bar in Grand Central Station, for instance, is celebrating its 98th birthday, 98 years of a restaurant in action the entire time, which is pretty amazing. And Whole Foods, one of our great sponsors, is celebrating 31 years. That surprised me. I didn't realize Whole Foods was around for 31 years. And the Culinary Historians of New York, we are embarking on our 36th season of lectures and programs. I'm very impressed with that. And another 36-year anniversary is the publication of The Art of Eating. Well, not in its present form, but certainly the newsletter and the magazine and the whole idea. And today I'm talking with the publisher and editor, the one-man show, Ed Baer of Art of Eating. Ed, are you there?
Good to be here. And just a small correction, you misspoke. Not the 36th anniversary of The Art of Eating, but we're a wee bit younger, only the 25th.
Well, now, I thought in 86 you first went up with the newsletter. I guess I had that wrong.
That's right.
Okay.
No, 86. It should come out. It should come out to 25th.
Okay. I've just added up wrong. That's pretty impressive, let me tell you. As Ed, when we were talking earlier, I said the first time I remember noticing The Art of Eating, I was walking through Kitchen Arts and Letters in Manhattan on Lexington Avenue, and Knock Waxman used to have this at the end of one of the bookshelves. There was a magazine rack with lots of, in those times there were a lot of little news sheets, newspapers, little, you know, two-page newsworthy newsletters, and
right there,
without fail, was always Ed Baer's newsletter, The Art of Eating. And now it has grown into a beautiful magazine.
Well, thank you.
Tell me, Ed, you, as I say, you are a one-man show. This magazine has absolutely no advertising, and it doesn't come out all that often. It's only four times a year, so it's understandable. That's
we struggle to do that much.
Yeah, and I'm sure. What inspired you to do this?
Oh boy, I'm often asked that, and the answer that always springs right to mind is naivete, which isn't really much of an answer at all. But I had no idea what I was getting into. I clearly, at some point, it came to me that I was much more interested in food than I had ever been consciously aware of.
And this came out of nowhere. I mean, you're not a chef. You're not a culinary historian.
And my mother was whose ethnicity is entirely English, American. I mean, going way, way back, but she just cooked plain food. It wasn't French or anything else. And but everybody loved to eat. And looking back, I realized that she and others in the family, you know, they were people who would talk at one meal about what we might be eating at the next meal, especially on vacations and times when you would be all together at meal after meal. I also had a very, this sounds silly maybe, but I had a really large appetite. I was pretty skinny, and I could just eat a lot of food. And even now in my relatively old age, I eat a lot for my size. And I just think I'm doing what I do largely because I get so much pleasure out of eating, which sounds very simple, but there it is.
Well, and everything you write about is not just food that normal people have at the table. It's the best of.
A little fairer to myself and not just dwell on the sensual. There is so much, as you know and listeners know, connected with food that has nothing to do with strict sensuality. It has to do with history and nature and farming and gardening and, I don't know, the seas and the skies and technique and even science. I mean, it just goes on and on. That same mother used to say to me when I began to write about food, and she said this almost right away. She said, "Aren't you going to run out of things to write about?" And I keep, you know, I have a computer file list of all the things that I could potentially write about in the future, and I'm always adding to it. And there are things that I've never done, and I'm really interested in, and they're still out there.
Well, what I love and I thank you for is that you indulge your writers, which was you for a long time, just you, and the articles, you know, how you'll pick up one of the regular glossies. We all know what they are, and we all love them, and we continue to get them and read them, but yep. You'll get a pinch or a snippet of, let's say, a Greek dessert, and you want to know a little bit more. You want to ask that next question. You want to go on, well, where did it come from? Well, what kind of sugars did they use? And you really do indulge your writers, and they go into depth. The articles are nice and leisurely and long. And you really, at the end of an article, you feel that you have learned something, or I feel I have learned something from this particular writer who has done a good amount of research. And yeah. And I really appreciate that. For instance, in this most recent issue, Considering Dessert, you have a nice long article about cider, but French-made cider, not...
Hard cider. In America, ever
hard cider. Right. And a nice composite of pastries, Considering Dessert. Several different types of desserts, several different writers. You've got one of our hosts here on the radio, Mitchell Davis, writing about Noma, the restaurant, the number one restaurant in the world as of the last voting. And each of them are in-depth articles by good writers, I might add, too. And that's the other thing I noticed about your magazine is that you have kind of raised the bar on magazine articles, and you're reaching out to a lot more established writers, I guess you'd say?
To some extent. I mean, I think we have a pretty good mix, and sometimes we have people who've never written before, which can be a risk that usually pans out, but I think a mix. We don't, you know, we want fresh voices, and I try when I edit and when other people edit to preserve the writer's voice and make it special. And let me go back just a wee bit, because you were talking about research and length and so on. And let me connect to that with my answer to the question as to why I do what I do. Every article is supposed to be about taste. We do history, or maybe even sometimes social history, but everything should be connected to taste. In other words, the history explains why things taste the way they do. And the notion, I mean, I thought of using the word authenticity, but that's become kind of fraught because people say, well, what's authentic? You know, what point in time? Who are we speaking of, and why, if you make a change, is it no longer authentic? It is still, you know,
endless and
maybe at some point not very interesting conversation. But what we're trying to do is to get at the essence of things, get at what makes this thing, whether it's an ingredient, a dish, a Norman cider, a whole cuisine, what makes it what it is and not something else? And that thing, that turning point, the fulcrum, is always taste.
That's true. And, well, you call it an independent print magazine of the best food and wine. Well, best I mean, and of course, that's taste is subjective, right?
That's as bad as authentic.
Well, we have to rely on someone to tell us what, what we should try.
I'm a big believer in making judgments, not in an unkind way, not necessarily in an exclusive way, but I don't want, you know, an onslaught of information. I want curated information. I want judgments, and best, obviously, for the most part in this case, is my judgment, but also the judgment of the writer. And I don't necessarily agree with absolutely everything that goes into the magazine.
Well, but it is, I mean, it is a wonderful compendium of people's opinions, and that's what makes it interesting
to read. And hopefully, you know, maybe we should be more aggressive and hard-edged and catch people's attention more with our opinions, but generally, I hope they're really persuasive and put forth in moderate language and well-argued and convincing so that nobody really is offended.
And oftentimes, they are just instructive as well, which I think
I've just been writing this, but the idea is partly is, and this sounds just like something you really can't sell the public on, but it's kind of like, it's about connoisseurship, and which is a word that I think maybe puts a lot of people off, but it's really teaching people how to get more pleasure out of food, teaching people enjoyment, teaching people about things that foods they may not have encountered before or not really gotten what they were because they only came across them. I mean, we're just about to go to press with something about quince, which is not something we meet a whole lot. And the same writer actually once upon a time, I don't know, a couple of years ago, did a piece on black currants, which taught me much more than I ever knew about black currants. Which
are now back again.
They are now back again. But I went and planted two Russian varieties that were mentioned in her piece, and then this summer made jam out of them. And lo and behold, it was a revelation. So now I've lost my train of thought. Enjoyment. There I am. I'm teaching myself some enjoyment.
Well, and in a sense, teaching people how to taste and to appreciate flavors and be discerning.
Yeah.
Well, bring us along a little bit. First of all, I have to mention that, you know, you'd think you'd find a magazine like this coming out of somebody who's in the midst, in the throes of the food world, all the happenings in the restaurants and the chefs in New York City or Los Angeles or San Francisco. You are way up in the Northeast Kingdom.
Yeah, probably a huge commercial mistake, but it's a terrific, you know, it's a terrific place to be if you want to write and get something done.
Way up in Vermont, someplace up there.
We're the closest big city is Montreal. Right now,
that's a pretty big food city.
Which is a pretty big food city. We're about 45 minutes from the Quebec border, and we're about, 3.25 hours from Boston, something like that. So we're way up in the poorest, coldest corner of Vermont, but also, probably for those reasons, maybe the most beautiful part of Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
So, not a bad place to be.
And this magazine can be found. Well, we're hoping it can be found in a lot more places.
But the readers are concentrated, you know, Manhattan, Chicago, Northern California, around San Francisco, L.A., and certain other places too, of course.
And tell us a little bit about how the magazine first started, or how the newsletter first started.
Oh boy! Well, that, you know. I was sort of in a back to the land moment, and living in this poor, cold part of Vermont, and you know, being a carpenter and building houses, and it was just so impecunious. I mean, you couldn't earn a living at that time in this part of the world. So, a friend of mine somehow started a building trades publication, living in a house just beyond mine, which I helped him build. That was at the end of this long dirt road where it was that time cheaper to bring in telephone than telephone plus power because the telephone poles could be lower than the ones that carried electricity. So he started this magazine. It was a kind of a tabloid, but he had a big, unlike me, he had a brilliant money-making idea. He perceived that there was a market for this thing he was doing that nobody else was doing, and eventually it turned into a real magazine, and he sold it for a large sum of money years later. But that he was able to do that, made me think, maybe I should be writing and publishing. So that kind of was a sort of a model for what I began to do.
Something to do on those long, cold, snowy winters, right? Well, it certainly has come. I mean, it was, and you literally just published what was like a 2-page newsletter, right?
It was 8 pages.
Oh, well, sorry.
And the design was, embarrassing to look back upon. But it quickly changed and got better, the design. And it was always from the start this rather purist thing. Obviously no ads, because in the beginning who would have advertised? But I remember I reviewed the book, The Bread Ovens of Quebec, and I wrote the entire review. And only just before I went to press did I realize the book was also available in English. So I apparently was making no concessions to my readers at the very beginning. I try to be a little more friendly to our readers now.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about where this has taken you and about this, the model of this magazine, when we come back after a short break. We are back, and I'm talking with Ed Baer, the editor and publisher of The Art of Eating. And Ed, you were mentioning how no advertising. Well, I was mentioning too, no advertising in the magazine. So, is that to say that you rely solely on subscriptions?
It is, and this is the thing that Chris Kimball figured out in Cooks Illustrated. Mm-hmm. He originally had a magazine called The Cooks Magazine that, he sold and was killed, but he came. That was a big glossy with ads, and then he realized that you could actually have a magazine with no ads. That it was a much simpler business to run, and that you could people would willingly pay more money for a subscription because they had a greater relationship of trust with the magazine. And that is in essence what I'm doing, though Chris executed it much more deftly in some ways for a larger audience than The Art of Eating has.
Well, one of the nice things that this has spawned is that a cookbook came out of this.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, for our 25th anniversary, I collected recipes, almost all of which had appeared in the magazine, and some of which were, nearly all of which I did, but I don't know, 10% or whatever, were done by my friend James McGuire, a chef in Montreal, who is, he's a living encyclopedia of classical French cooking and a terrific baker. Anyway, I threw myself into turning these recipes into a book. I was just expecting to cut and paste in a Word file, and I found that I just did vast quantities of revision, rethinking, rewriting, adding, and so on, hopefully making a book that's very much a whole and that stands up and has lasting value and offers a lot of reading, because some of the introductions to the recipes are longer than the recipes.
Which I think is so sorely missing in many of our cookbooks today. I love that. Give a little flavor of where the recipe came from, what it should look like, what it should taste like. That to me is very important.
Yeah, I was trying, and not perhaps every recipe did I succeed, but the idea was once again my standard theme. I was really trying to present the essence of the thing. You know, mm-hmm. What makes it the most what it is? If it's ragu bolognese, if it's now, of course, I'll draw a blank and can't think of anything that's in the book, but if it's tapenade or something, that's very familiar, all these things, what makes them what they are? It's not that there's a single definitive recipe, but the description, at least, and together with the recipe, present a picture of what makes them really what they are and not something else,
right.
Not some other spaghetti meat sauce, not some other whirled up olive paste.
Well, and it's a very easy title to remember. It's The Art of Eating Cookbook, and that I think that people will be pleased to pick that up and read through those recipes. It gives you kind of a feeling and a background of, as you say, a springboard to experiment and go further. But there you get the essence of the food. And you do quite a bit of cooking, I might add. I remember reading some articles that Nancy Harmon Jenkins wrote an article about you way back when, about
New York Times.
What a great baker you were.
That's true. I have a half-written bread book that I've had for years. I'm in the midst of doing too many things, including too many books, and that will probably be the last book that ever comes out. But bread was the subject of my very first food letter, the very first issue of The Art of Eating. And I've always just had a powerful interest in bread. For years, I baked my own bread. And then, of course, perhaps like a certain number of other home bakers, when there began to be really good bread available nearby, my ambition was undercut, and I began to buy bread so that I only rarely make bread. But I just love bread. I think it's, you know, I think bread is one of those hugely underestimated things. And when I go to a restaurant and it's treated as an appetizer, they give you a little and then they take it away. I'm always kind of offended because my big thing is that bread is something that makes other foods taste better, you know, especially when you have sauce, certain things, liquidy things in particular. And the idea that bread should be taken away for the bulk of the meal just seems to me a fundamental misunderstanding of all of Western cooking. But there you have it.
Yeah. Well,
and there is a very little bit. There is a little bit of bread in the new cookbook, but not a deep.
Well, and there are usually always recipes in the magazine.
Yes, you know, there are always recipes. Yeah. Hopefully, really well considered and fairly deep, but usually I don't know, 3, 6.
Well, now tell me about the articles in the magazine. I mean, they sometimes don't always. I mean, like the hard cider and then the feature spread, which are, you know, considering desserts. So you do kind of run different.
We try to provide
some
variety. I mean, years ago, I devoted a single issue to a single article with no recipes. I don't feel badly about it. I really like it, even in retrospect, but it was a whole issue on Provençal goat cheeses with nothing else. Well, now we try to provide more things for more people and to have restaurant reviews and book reviews and recommendations for sources of supply and wine reviews and vary the content. I wouldn't be opposed to an even narrower single theme piece, but it's harder to get really wonderful stuff on the same narrow theme.
Well, and you want to reach out to as many readers as possible too. Yeah. I mean, you know, and still be true to your philosophy of what you're doing. But tell me, with these, are you soliciting the articles mostly, or are you? Do you have a big enough name now people approach you?
Yeah, mostly things that come out of the blue aren't quite right because people don't, we do have writer's guidelines. I mean, we have this notion that everything should turn on taste, and people aren't always so aware of that. But we are, you know, any great piece of writing, we're certainly eager and grateful for it.
Mm-hmm. Because you don't, I mean, I noticed in looking through all my past issues in preparation, I noticed that you don't really have a stable of writers that you keep going back to and relying on necessarily.
No, there are certain people who recur, mm-hmm. but it's not a fixed group, and I like that.
I do too. I think that's what makes the magazine special. It always has a fresh take on something. Mm-hmm. Fresh meaning, you know, it's not the same point of view. It's sometimes jaded, sometimes, you know, too assuming. It's always a fresh outlook on whatever someone's writing about, and I do appreciate that.
Yeah, it's almost a relief because, of course, my own tendencies, I'm so anchored in sort of traditional French and Italian food especially, and so I work very hard not to have that be a limit and to go beyond it and to publish things that perhaps challenge a bit that point of view.
Mm-hmm. And yet you don't, now some people may consider it to be too much of an elitist magazine, but...
Well, years ago when I was starting out, somebody offered that as a criticism. And anything that's very good or tries to be very good is elite in its way. So I'm not entirely sure that's a criticism. It is true that, you know, it costs a lot of money to produce a really good small circulation magazine. So, yes, I wish the price of the subscription were less, but it's the way it works out. And I don't know what to say beyond
Well, nice to have a very generous patron. That wouldn't hurt.
Yeah. More subscription. And the cookbook is a good value, I think.
And that's what I was thinking. The cookbook, of course, can help, you know, help move things along, too, and get people's, you know, turn people's eye to the magazine, which, you know, one thing lead to another.
And
you never know.
I think, you know, the magazine, more than the cookbook, is really for people who love both food and love to read, in that they want a longer article. They want more substance. There are people like me who, when they read an article in a magazine that comes to an early end, you think, oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
So it's not for everybody. And yet, I think we work hard to make it really accessible, not to assume any, you know, not to use food and wine jargon, not to assume that people know anything in particular, but to write it for everyone on various levels of knowledge and appreciation. So,
Well, it's interesting.
I don't want to be elitist in that.
No, and I just say that because I know that it has been a perception, but I don't think it is either. I mean, I think anyone who wants to know more about food, whether they can afford to buy the different things that are, you know, involved in it, but it's all about the natural product, the original product.
Absolutely, good. Really great food doesn't have to be expensive.
That's right.
I mean, really great food can be expensive, but really great food can be potatoes and onions and milk.
You bet.
I mean,
you bet.
Cabbage. You know, there are things that occur on and have occurred in classical on the tables of the aristocrats and the very rich that are basic humble ingredients.
Well, it's interesting because I was reading the article about cider last week or a few weeks ago, I guess. And I thought, oh, I was considering doing a show on cider. Oh, well, maybe I'll call Ed Baer. He would have some names of some good cider makers, maybe some experts that I could interview. And as I was thinking of that, I said, well, why don't I just interview Ed? Because I found out about this through the magazine, and he would be a person to interview about this model of a great magazine. And I just hope that you can keep it coming because it's something that I really do appreciate. And I thank you very much for spending time to share your thoughts on this. And I encourage people to read. You've got a website too, theartofeating.com?
Artofeating.com, mm-hmm. Sure. And okay. The book is on Amazon and elsewhere. Yeah.
So it's easily accessible. And I hope people will take a look at it and enjoy it as much as I do. Thank you so much for joining me, Ed.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. This is a message from Fork and Anchor. Aaron Fitzpatrick, the host of our wine program, Unfiltered, is looking for help on Kickstarter to open Fork and Anchor, a general store inspired by two food-loving ladies with an equal affection for urban life, the sea, and the agricultural paradise of Long Island's North Fork. The store is situated in a growing community of farmers and winemakers and will become a meeting place offering prepared foods, a variety of sun-dries, and a selection of homespun products, many of which will have their origins in New York State. Your backing will help them fulfill their dream of fostering relationships with the community and making the local food system accessible on a broader scale. Search Kickstarter.com for Fork and Anchor and donate today. The Heritage Meat Shop has just opened in the Essex Street Market. Open from 9 to 7 Monday through Saturday and 10 to 6 on Sundays, the Heritage Meat Shop supports independent family farms and animal welfare approved and certified humane raising standards. Most importantly, they offer a wide variety of heritage breeds. So stop by, get a sandwich, try the charcuterie, the Heritage Meat Shop at the Essex Street Market. The following is a message from Heritage Foods USA. 14 family farms and over 50 restaurants have committed to participation in No Goat Left Behind, a new program developed by Heritage Foods USA, a meat distribution company dedicated to preserving endangered breeds. Without an end market, the majority of male dairy goats are sold into the commodity market or killed at birth. Dairy farmers are always struggling with feed prices, milk prices, and weather. Goats usually have twins or triplets, and for every female who will become a milker, there is a male buckling who will become a financial drain. It makes no sense that these males are sold into the commodity market or put to death when the United States imports almost 50% of its annual goat supply. Home consumers interested in participating can order goats through heritagefoodsusa.com. They will receive goats via FedEx, and home delivery is available for New York City customers. In addition to the goat, these packages will also include recipes and a DVD featuring interviews with the farmers, processors, and chefs demonstrating how to break down and cook goat. Again, for more information on No Goat Left Behind, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com or call Aaron Fairbanks at 718-389-0985.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.